Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. Thanks for being here. It means a lot to me that you showed up. Pardon my voice. I'm getting over a pretty long cold for the last 2 weeks, so I might be a little rough on some enunciation or some pronunciation. Yeah, I might even have COVID. My coworker just called in for COVID, so, and most likely I'm the one who got him sick. My son's still sick, and he's been sick for like a week longer than me, which is crazy. So yeah, I've just been thinking a lot about how I can make the best of my time, even though I might be in a physically disruptive situation. So this week I want to talk about set and setting. Any long-term listeners of the show will know that I have a very heavy psychedelic influence. I've been using psychedelics from a very young age. The first time I ever tried mushrooms, I was probably about 13 years old. Not that that's a recommendation or an advocation for anybody to be doing it. And I only really started using these tools effectively and constructively in probably the last 5 or 6 years. So most of my experience was just playing around or being a kid in the adult pool with no swimmers, and then I was getting scared and having all these situations that I couldn't rationalize and turn into something that I could use as world-making material or meaning-making material. So when I started using them correctly, came with a lot of other activities outside of that high space. You know, I was doing a lot more reading, I was starting to meditate, and I was doing a lot of mindfulness practices, really deeply watching my inner microcosms ebb and flow and my own inner tides, because I'm sitting here in this vessel that contains my body, you know? Well, this vessel that is my body, that contains my being and all the different sections of my being. Sorry for that confusion. But this vessel has its own needs and desires. And in a way, that is the setting of set and setting. The set is the environment itself. And I would say it doesn't matter if you're getting high or taking any chemicals or wanting to do any of those other experiments that I was doing. I think that any person at any point in their life can utilize this principle of set and setting as a good qualifier for decision making, because then we can start to analyze what's going on, and we don't act from impulse, we don't act from instinct, we don't have these unconditional reactions from trauma cycles and from pain. We can critically think about, where am I, what's going on, what's the best thing I could do right now? Because at any moment in time where we sit here in the present land, we have this spider web of choices available to us. A lot of people, including myself, at points in time would probably say that we are free, or we have freedom based upon what we can do. But at any moment in time, we have a multiplicity of choices that we can do. All these different things we can do. I can sit down. I can stand up. I can go to work. I cannot. You know, I can act like an ass. I cannot. There's all these things that we can do, you know? And in this ever-present, present moment that is so short and fleeting, yet ever continuing into ever, we are assaulted with all these things that we could do. But why do we choose what we do? What are we going to do? You know, what makes us have the volition to choose this over that thing? You know, there's all these motivations that then arise. There's all these things that seep out of this unconscious that may not be available to what's on the surface of our conscious mind. You know, what are our motives? If we have motives, are they dependent upon this long chain of events that goes back and back and back to the beginning of our time? And yet there could be a chain of events before our being that caused our being to come in the procreative sexual act of our parents in union. And what about all the acts that happened in their lives? How far back would you follow back that deterministic chain? You know, these are some questions that I end up thinking about, because there's this mass of influence within myself that motivates me to choose what I can do. And this is this inner setting, this emotional temper that can also be built off of our base character. Do you have a base character? You know, I sort of agree with this sentiment, and I sort of don't. Because in a way, I do feel that my soul, my spark, my Atman, whatever is inside that is purely just an observational force that doesn't have any part to play. And I was sitting on my bed the other day thinking about this, and I have very active psychodramas in my head where I'll have conversations with myself, you know, chemically and unchemically. But to be honest, the first time I started easily being able to flow into that state of being able to speak with myself was during chemical states. But I'm sitting inside my head and I'm discussing some difficulty, some frustration or aggression that I had at Forefront. And without my meaning to, it's like I'm not really writing the script, which is what's funny about this. You know, a part of me goes, you know, well, it doesn't matter, man. I love you. You love me. The big eye upstairs, he's seeing all this. And it made me laugh, because at first, when I first heard it, I was like, big guy. And I thought, God. But then it was said, big eye. You know, not big guy, like big eye. Like that eye-centric version. You know, we all have an eye, but we have a lot of different eyes because we're a multifaceted being, you know. But there's a big eye sitting way up somewhere inside my head that's always watching. And I can trace that back all the way to when I was very, very little. And I've always been a very aware person. And I remember watching myself when I was very young, in a very neurotic way too, almost, which caused a lot of stress throughout my teenage years when I was adapting. But we all have that spark, that essence of specialness that allows us to have consciousness. It's the baseline, it's the frame, it's the thread that holds together all the different thoughts of this biological mechanism that I am not convinced may have a purely biological basis, you see. So this I is somehow holding together this patchwork, you know? And depending on where you are in your day, and depending on what's going on and how you are, you might have a lot of different faces that you show people. And this doesn't make you schizophrenic in any way, shape, or form. I think it just makes us all that much more special. It doesn't make us disassociated. It just means that we're human. And when we're in a hard spot, we're going to have a much different approach than if we are happy and relaxed. And as a human, we're always in this back and forth tug of war between, you know, distress and boredom, of being just completely out of our mind with stress and pressure and being so bored to stimulate ourselves. You know, and this humanness, I would say, really creates a tension for where we are right now and where we see ourselves in our ideals in our head. And so this brings up, I guess, much more of the influence part of the talk. I've been reading from this book by this guy named Viktor Frankl. Viktor Frankl was a resident prisoner of Auschwitz during the Holocaust. He had a very, very hard time of existence for almost 6 or 7 years, I believe, during World War II. And if you don't know what the Holocaust is, just go do a little bit more research. He developed a psychotherapeutic model based on his struggles and based on his own rationalizations of his own existence that he called logotherapy. Logos, from the Greek, root, means meaning, and therapy is, we therapize. So logos therapy is meaning therapy. And instead of thinking of somebody as having broken pieces and maladaptations to their environment, this therapy assumes that what a person needs is a meaning to work towards, and it's that ideal. And I've always been hesitant about living life too idealistically, because then we can live purely inside of our minds and we can become insane. But when there is a healthy ideal that is linked to purpose, that has to do with what we deem as our meaning in life. And he speaks a lot about looking backwards and imagining yourself on your deathbed. Imagine yourself looking back and taking count for your entire life. And if you were to go through all your memories, how would you feel up to this point? Would you feel that you lived well? And that could lead to existential crisis or a noogenic crisis that has to do with a lack of meaning, and it creates a vacuum within ourselves. And then there can be all kinds of misintentions and weird reactions on the outside because of this vacuum of meaning within ourselves. And so, at any point of any day, when we approach any situation, we have a different meaning in that moment, because there's not some one blanket meaning for a person. Depending on what plate is being given to you and what challenge you are trying to surface, you will have a different meaning in that moment from moment to moment, in my mind. And so it really comes to grace. How can we make our meaning gracefully? The three treasures of the Tao Te Ching are love, humility, and moderation. These things don't come from seeking, they don't come from striving, they don't come from force. And these things are part of our natural humanity. When we find it hard to love someone, this is because there's something confused, and perhaps there's something confused in how we're finding our purpose in that moment. When we're having a hard time being humble and we're being taken away by our ego and our desires for some sort of gain, we are confused on what our base nature is. When we are immoderate, and we lose control of, I guess not control, but when we allow ourselves to utilize the environment recklessly, which with our necessary inherent part of being in that environment, it means we're using ourselves recklessly. We are confused. And we are further away from what our base humanity is. See, I think my emotional settings and what most of Western men and women now are very confused in all of these ideas and these things. And this makes it really hard to pick the best decision when we find ourselves in those difficult moments. So, I've just spoken a lot about a lot of different things that could be part and participants of these settings that we find ourselves in. And then we have a set that we are in. So, my set right now is early morning. You know, I've just woken up, so my setting, my inner being is revitalized from sleep and I'm strong, which is why I like to do this now. But my set is this home, and it brings with it comfort, but also implies necessity for responsibility because I have to keep it clean. I have to do all these things to make my home nice. I have to stock it with food. So that requires things to do, you know, and all these requirements of things to do are natural in our lives. You know, we're required to go to work because we have to subsist in this type of society. All these things that we have to do, you know, that's a set. And if we look at it really, really closely, I think we have the tendency to be able to find patterns in the set. You know, the set is revolving and has a lot of different draperies, and the stage crew is very quick, you know. But Monday at 7 o'clock, I will be at work, just like I was for the last 65 Mondays. You know, I can rely on that and know with some consistency what my set's going to be. When it comes to the chemical set taking, you know, I've used small amounts of psychedelics in almost every single situation possible. It's because I've been experiencing with how my brain will bend and adapt to different situations. And sometimes not to the best result. It's not smart to take anything when we know that it's going to be a little harder. You know? Sober mind is the best one to take care of insanity. And what I mean by insanity is the maladaptive behaviors that we have towards a stimulus that's recurrent. You know, if you don't like your boss, if you're having a difficulty with a person in your life, if you're having a hard time changing a pattern of behavior like smoking or drinking in your life, you know, just think about it a little bit. Think about all the different influences that we find ourselves in and that we inhabit. Where is your body now? What is your set? How is your day yesterday? Are you worried about anything tomorrow? Is this revving up your inner engines in any way? Just think about it. It might be helpful for some to have like a journal and to try to chart it. I used to do that. Sometimes it might just be helpful to get into the habit of looking. Make sure that you keep your eyes wide open and you know what you're doing. We don't have to be automatons and robots. We're human. We're beautiful creatures, surrounded by beautiful creatures. We have a capacity for love. And I have a really cool little excerpt by the Frankl guy I was just talking about, where he was talking about the meaning of love here in a moment. For me, love is a natural human attribute. It's the material of our soul. And we have the capacity to unconditionally love a stranger. And that love is infectious. We humans are also curious. And I find that curiosity not only endearing, compelling, but I think it's linked to purpose. And like most things within this social complex, I wholeheartedly believe that our creativity and curiosity is infectious. And by going out and being passionate about what we're interested in and pursuing our meaning, we can inspire others to be passionate and want to be creative and curious individuals so that they can go find their meaning and they can break out of the automatic living that's conditioned into this way of life. You have an immense control and capacity over your own being. And part of being in a being is being able to let go. And letting go is this weird thing where you are completely in control, but you're not controlling. Wu Wei, an active action. All right. Well, that's my guess for today. I'm gonna go grab a good book real quick, and we'll do a little bit of quotations, and then we'll see how Odin's weeks have been, and then I'm gonna let you go. I really appreciate you being here. I will forever be grateful to have this moment with you, and the fact that you wanted to hear my thoughts gives my life so much value. And I hope to see you again next week. You are loved, and I'm so grateful that you woke up and took a breath this morning. All right. This is Alan Watts, Become What You Are. A collection of loosely related essays, like short essays by the late Alan Watts. Alan Watts was a psychedelic speaker, and just all around Eastern philosopher, East-West mishmash philosopher. He was an English professor and came to America and became a drunk. He hung out with people like Timothy Leary, Richard Alpert, aka Ram Dass, and a lot of those in the hippie movement. I don't look at all of his baggage so much when I think about the root of what he's saying. He's always spoken very clearly to me, which is why I continue to read and listen to him. You can hear hundreds of hours of his talks on YouTube. So if you like this, I highly encourage you to go look at more of his material. This short essay is called Walking on the Wheel. All right, here goes. Almost every fundamental principle of life can be expressed in two opposite ways. There are those who say that to attain the highest wisdom, we must be still and calm, immovable in the midst of turmoil. And there are those who say that we must move on as life moves, never stopping for a moment either in fear of what is to come or to turn a regretful glance at what has gone. The former are those who listen to music, letting the flow of notes pass through their minds without trying to either arrest them or to speed them on. Like Chuang Tzu, perfect man, they employ their minds as a mirror. It grasps nothing. It refuses nothing. It receives, but does not keep. The latter are those who dance to music, keeping pace with its movement and letting their limbs flow with it as unceasingly and as hesitatingly as clouds respond to the breath of a wind. The one seems to reflect events as they pass, and the other to move forward with them. But points of view, however, are true. For to attain that highest wisdom, we must at once walk on and remain still. Consider life as a revolving wheel set upright, with man walking on its tire. As he walks, the wheel is revolving around him beneath his feet. And if he is not to be carried backward by it and flung to the ground, he must walk at the same speed as the wheel turns. If he exceeds that speed, he will topple forward and slip off the wheel onto his face. For at every moment we stand, as it were, on the top of a wheel. Immediately we try to cling to that moment, to that particular point of the wheel, It is no longer at the top, and we are off our balance. Thus, by not trying to seize the moment, we keep it. For the second we fail to walk on, we cease to remain still. Yet within this, there is still a deeper truth. From the standpoint of eternity, we never can and never do leave the top of the wheel. For if a circle is set in infinite space, it has neither top nor bottom. Whether you stand at the top, it revolves only because you are pushing it around with your own feet. Yeah, I like that one quite a bit. It's just a really good, interesting metaphor for that present moment. It's ungraspable. To hold the moment is like holding water. And anything based in time is impermanent and is worthy of doubt when it comes to lucidity. All right. This next one is from Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, an Introduction to Logotherapy. The first two-thirds of the book is an autobiography of some of his accounts while being in the concentration camps. A lot of it's pretty hard to read, but he was soft in his approach. So he wasn't trying to traumatize people. At least not that's not how I felt. This is from the end of the book, where he's giving a much more detailed attempt at describing what logotherapy is. And in his definitions of terms, I found this. This comes from the subheading, The Meaning of Love. Love is the only way to grasp another human being in the innermost core of his personality. No one can become fully aware of the very essence of another human being unless he loves him. By his love, he is enabled to see that essential trait and features in the beloved person. And even more, he sees that which is potential in him, which is not yet actualized, but yet ought to be actualized. Furthermore, by his love, the loving person enables the beloved person to actualize these potentialities. By making him aware of what he can be and of what he could become, he makes these potentialities come true. In logotherapy, love is not interpreted as a mere epiphenomenon of sexual drives and instincts in the sense of a so-called sublimation. Love is a primary phenomenon as sex. Normally, sex is a mode of expression for love. Sex is justified, even sanctified, as soon as, but only as long as, it is a vehicle of love. Thus, love is not understood as a mere side effect of sex. Rather, sex is a way of expressing the experience of that ultimate togetherness which is called love. Yeah, I like him quite a bit. He's got a lot of really good stuff to say. All right. Well, there's all my words. I'm going to go grab Odin. Thank you again.
Hello, it's been a long time since I've seen you, so... And... Okay. I forgot, so...
Talk about something. What are you doing? What are you happy about?
Okay, this is just going to be quick. What's happiness?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Happiness is a...
So nervous.
Feeling.
It's a feeling? Right here?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you like it?
Yeah.
Yeah? Pretty good stuff? Yeah. I love you.
Love you.
Mm. Yeah, have a chill day.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're getting over a cold.
Well, I still have a sore throat.
I know, me too. All right, guys. Have a good week.
I like having like a really, really sore throat.
We love you. Bye.
Daddy, but I kind of like have like a really, really sore throat.
Mm-hmm.